some of these stories look like they could really happen. In the Old Testament, in the book of Judges, there's a story about an Israelite named Gideon. And at that moment in history, the Israelites had become obsessed with idolatry. And God had handed the Israelites over to the Midianites to be oppressed. The Midianites are raiding their crops. They're taking their livestock. Many of the Israelites had been reduced to poverty, and they are off kind of in hiding. Like literally, they're hiding in caves, hiding in different places because of the oppression that's taking place. And in the midst of all of that, the Israelites begin to cry out to God for help. And God hears their cries, and he sends an angel to a man named Gideon. Gideon is from the tribe of Manasseh, which is not very impressive, all right? It's not the pick of the litter by any sort of means. Manasseh is likely the weakest of all of the tribes of Israel. And in the tribe of Manasseh, Gideon is from the weakest clan. There's lots of different groups even within the tribe. And of all those groups, Gideon's is the weakest. And even within his family, within the clan, within the tribe, within the nation, he's the youngest. He's the weakest of his family. Gideon is the weakest of the weakest of the weakest of the weak. And when the angel shows up, Gideon is threshing wheat. He's harvesting some of his crops, which seems normal enough, except that he's threshing wheat down in a hole inside of a wine press. He's hiding, largely because he's a coward. He's the weakest of the weakest of the weakest of the weak, and he's hiding. And an angel of the Lord shows up and calls him Mighty Warrior, which is completely contradictory to everything that you would believe or assume or know about Gideon. The angel tells Gideon that he's going to be commissioned to save Israel, and Gideon doubts it. He doesn't believe it. He questions everything that this angel says because he is definitively not a mighty warrior. And yet God chooses him. And the very first thing that God has Gideon do is he asks him to tear down an altar that had been built by his father for a false god named Baal. And he does. In the middle of the night, he gets some friends. They go out. They tear this altar down. Gideon builds a new altar to God, and he sacrifices a bull on that altar. And it's a small moment where you think, okay, maybe there is something here. Maybe he is a mighty warrior. The Midianites and the other nations around Israel who worship Baal, they're upset about what's happened. They rally together. They begin to prepare for war against Israel. Gideon responds by sending a call out to rally his own troops, and 32,000 men respond, which sounds like maybe a glimpse into the potential, like maybe Gideon could be a mighty warrior. Except that Gideon doesn't really even believe in himself. He doesn't believe in any of this. He's not sure that God's actually doing anything with him or through him or for him. And so he has this back and forth with God. There's a famous story about fleece and laying it out overnight and it being made wet or being kept dry. And all of it is just these questions of Gideon and zero confidence. And he doesn't look like a mighty warrior. Then God tells him, well, this 32,000 people that you've gathered, that's too big of an army, which is not typically the perspective you have when you're going into war, but God says it's too big. And so he tells Gideon, if there's anyone who's fearful, just send them home. They don't have to stay. And so 22,000 of the 32,000 who came didn't really show up hoping to fight. And so they go home. And he's down to 10,000 men. God says that's still too much. He tells Gideon to take his men down to the river, and he tells them to watch how they drink. 300 of the men take water and lift it from the river up to their mouths and drink, and God says, I want you to keep them. The rest just put their head into the water and begin slurping. God says, we don't need them. Gideon is left with 300 men, has some trumpets, he has some jars, some torches, and God says, I have everything I need. So that next night, he sends Gideon and his men, this mighty warrior, to sneak up on that Midianite camp in the middle of the night. This camp had 120,000 soldiers. And Gideon takes his 300. He splits them each into groups of 100. They surround the camp kind of up on a ridge around them. And they all of a sudden just kind of blow their trumpets. They smash their jars. They lift up their torches. And then they all shout together a sword for the Lord and for Gideon. And it causes absolute panic within the camp of the Midianites. They don't know what's happening. They're woke up. They've been drinking. It's just pure chaos. They end up like attacking one another. It's a crazy situation until some of them begin to flee. And that is probably the greatest military moment of Gideon's leadership, when all he does is break some jars and blow some trumpets. And that's the closest he gets to really being a mighty warrior. Mighty warrior. Was Gideon a mighty warrior? Really? God calls him a mighty warrior, but each of his victories are actually just laughable. Even after Gideon tears down that whole altar to Baal, like everyone's upset and they come out looking for Gideon, and Gideon's dad has to kind of defend him and protect him, which doesn't make him look very much like a mighty warrior. God's the one who delivers the greatest victories. Gideon's the one, he lived in weakness and in doubt and in fear. He was a coward, way more than he was confident or courageous. So why would God call him a mighty warrior? Now, this isn't the only time that the Bible does something like this. I think Gideon is the perfect model, but it happens so many other times. God routinely uses unqualified people to accomplish his work. Before Gideon was a guy named Moses who was a murderer and was hiding in a distant land, and he has a speech impediment and he doesn't have any confidence. And when he calls King David, David is the youngest of eight brothers. He's small in stature. He has no training. He's not of royal lineage. There isn't anything about King David that would say you need to pick him to be the next king. It's the same in the New Testament. When Jesus begins gathering his disciples, he starts with very common people, common fishermen, people like Peter and John. Later in the book of Acts, those two men, Peter and John, are specifically called unschooled, ordinary men, not as a compliment, because there's nothing special about them. And so look at the people that God picks. Each of them looks weak at some point in their life. Each of them looks unqualified. They aren't the first choice. Each of them have a great moment of failure even, and yet each of them have moments of great success, moments when you could potentially call them mighty warrior. What is it that makes them a mighty warrior? What is it that would make us a mighty warrior? Is it something that we have within us? Is it something that we're just able to do on our own? Is it the potential that God sees in them or that he sees in us? Or is it something else completely? Here's the answer, and then I'm going to show you where I find this answer. Mighty heroes or mighty warriors never set out to be heroes. They only set out to do what God asks them to do. And then God puts them in positions where they aren't capable of doing on their own. And they find their sufficiency comes from him. And that may be a really big reverse for you today. It may change how you view yourself, and it will potentially also change how you think God sees you. Let me show you where I get it from. It comes from 2 Corinthians chapter 11. And there's some things going on in the background within this church. There's a big problem that Paul, the writer of 2 Corinthians, has been dealing with. He's been struggling with what he calls super apostles. And they're in quotation marks because he's almost saying it like tongue-in-cheek, like it's a sarcastic, mocking term. Paul started the Corinthian church, but then he left. He moved on because that's what he did. He'd start churches, he'd move on to a new place and go plant a new church somewhere else. And so he's moved on to the next place, which means that other people stepped into leadership at this church that he's left behind. And these people were obsessed with making themselves look good. And so they would speak poorly about Paul to make themselves look better. And then they would speak highly of themselves. Now, here's just a side note on all of this morning. When a leader of Jesus' followers, and that includes me, that includes the elders and the leaders of this church, when a leader becomes obsessed with making themselves look good, then you can bet that they're encroaching on leading Jesus' followers astray. Because pride is the opposite of Jesus. Jesus was all about humility. I believe humility is the top characteristic, the number one thing that has to exist in any leader of Jesus' followers. And that's the problem in the Corinthian church. And Paul knows it, which means that Paul has to do something about it. To some extent, Paul has to fight back, not for himself. He's not trying to defend his own reputation. He's fighting back, I believe, for the sake of the Corinthian church. He's fighting back for the sake of the people who he believes are being led astray. In this situation, the gospel is at risk. People are claiming to be leaders for Jesus, but they're acting the exact opposite. So, how does Paul fight back? Well, he decides to boast, which I think would probably be the opposite of what you would assume or expect. But because these super apostles are full of pride, and Paul decides that he's just going to beat them at their own game. And so starting chapter 11, verse 21, he says, whatever anyone else dares to boast about, and he says, I'm speaking as a fool, which I love. I love that. He calls out the fact that he himself is acting foolish, but he says that if they're going to boast about stuff, then he wants to also boast about stuff. He's going to challenge them at their own foolish game. And so he says, are they Hebrews? So am I. Are they Israelites? So am I. Are they Abraham's descendants? So am I. Are they servants of Christ? And again, like, this is just so ridiculous, this little battle that he's found himself in. So he has to say it again. He says, I'm out of my mind to talk like this. But he says, I'm more. I'm better than they are. I'm better at following Jesus. He says, I'm more of a servant of Christ. He says, I've worked much harder. Apparently, these super apostles have some credentials, but so does Paul. Paul isn't like the rest of Jesus' disciples, the ones who were ordinary, unschooled men. He was different. Paul had a pedigree. Paul would have been the one that you would pick first if you were trying to find someone to help you start a religious movement. In fact, you might even ask the question, why didn't Jesus ask Paul to follow him when Jesus was gathering his disciples? If Paul was so qualified, why didn't Jesus go find him? Well, probably because Paul was overqualified to be Jesus' disciple. Probably because Paul already was a disciple of a different guy named Gamaliel. Paul had a promising future out in front of him. He would have had to walk away from the prestige and the position that he was working towards in order to go and follow Jesus. He would have had to give it all up. It doesn't look like Gideon. Paul was legitimately a religious, mighty warrior. He has some things to boast about. Paul keeps boasting. He's not done yet. But it does take a very weird turn. So he says, I have worked much harder. He says, I've been in prison more frequently. I've been flogged more severely. I've been exposed to death again and again. Five times I received from the Jews the 40 lashes minus one. Three times I was beaten with rods. Once I was pelted with stones. Three times I was shipwrecked. I spent a night and a day in the open sea. I've been constantly on the move. I've been in danger from rivers, in danger from bandits, in danger from my fellow Jews, in danger from Gentiles, in dangers in the city, in danger in the country, in danger at sea. I'm in danger from false believers. I've labored and toiled and have often gone without sleep. I've known hunger and thirst and have often gone without food. I have been cold and naked. Paul boasts over the pain and the suffering that he's endured for following Jesus. Reminds me back to something we mentioned a few weeks ago. It's from Acts chapter 9. It's the story of Paul's conversion. And there's this moment in the story where Jesus sends someone named Ananias to Paul to go and heal his blindness, but also to deliver a message. And the message is kind of scary. Jesus tells Ananias to tell Paul, I'm going to show him how much he must suffer for my name. And Jesus wasn't joking. Paul has been through a lot. And the thing is, Paul is the one who's writing this letter, which means that he's still alive, which means that there's probably more suffering out in front of him that is yet to come. Paul says there are other burdens that he could boast about as well. He says, besides everything else, I face daily the pressure of my concern for all the churches. He says, who is weak and I don't feel weak? Who is led to sin and I don't inwardly burn? On top of all of the physical burdens that Paul has carried, you can also add the mental strain of caring for the churches that he started. The people that he's reached with the gospel weigh on his mind. When they feel weak, Paul feels that weakness. He carries their pain and their burdens. When they struggle with leaving their old life behind, Paul grieves deeply for them. He feels a deep empathy for those that he has led to Jesus. He says, so if I must boast, I will boast of the things that show my weakness. And there's a reverse. Paul says, I'm going to boast, and when I do, I'm going to boast about hardships. I'm going to boast about my sufferings. I'm going to boast about the things that show my weakness. How do you view the hard things in your life? Are they embarrassing things that you're supposed to hide, or are they the things that you celebrate because that's where you see God working? Paul looks back, and he sees the pain and the difficulty in his life, but he doesn't just see the pain and difficulty. He also sees the ways that God used those moments to share the gospel with people who desperately needed to hear it. The pain and the difficulty in his life is actually evidence of God's working. Paul sees the pain and the difficulty in his life as being the reasons why he's had any success in spreading the gospel message. The pain and the struggles were actually catalysts for his success. But it's not even his success, because it's not his own power, it's not about his abilities, and it's not about his potential. It's all about Jesus. It's in Paul's moments of weakness, Jesus has been given a platform to work. And that's what he celebrates. And I think that's about as countercultural as it gets. Because we measure ourselves and we measure others on our strengths and our abilities. In fact, we do everything we can to put our best foot forward. We put on the happy face. We hide behind our accomplishments and our successes. Social media has even created this idea of humble bragging. It's the ways that we find to brag without looking like we're bragging. The passive ways that we show off who we are or what we're doing. We do everything we can to hide our weaknesses. We don't want to be known for our failures. We don't want to be known for our low points. We want to do everything we can to hide the weakest parts of ourselves. And what's really interesting about all of this is that Paul still isn't done bragging. It spills into chapter 12. In fact, it's a really strange passage that creates a lot more questions than we can deal with this morning. I encourage you to go read it another time. But eventually, Paul admits that he's prayed that some of the difficulties he's had would be removed from him. Which leads us to what I believe is really the main point of all of this boasting in the first place. He says that he's prayed that God would remove these pains, but that Jesus has responded to him, and Jesus has said to Paul, "My grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness." My power is made perfect in weakness. Jesus is the hero of the story. And it's obvious he's the hero when he works out of our weaknesses. My strengths are the space where I get to be the hero. But me being the hero isn't good for me. It leads to pride, and that creates problems in my soul. But me being the hero isn't even good for you, because inevitably I will fail you. I cannot live up to your expectations. I will let you down. See, this was never about Paul's success or Paul's suffering or his weaknesses. And it was never about Gideon's weaknesses or his strength. It was never about Moses' weaknesses or his strength. It was never about Peter or John's weaknesses and their strength. It has always been about God. It's always been about his strength that shows up marvelously in the weaknesses of those who serve him. And when God shows up through our weaknesses, people get saved. That's the equation here. When God shows up in Moses and Gideon in the Old Testament, through their weaknesses, a nation is saved. When God shows up in Peter and John and Paul in the New Testament, through their weaknesses, people get saved. Not through their strengths, not through their positions, not through their influence, not through anything else that we could ever point to. When God shows up and works through their struggles and their weaknesses, people come flocking to the gospel message. Because God is always the hero of the story. God chooses weak, broken, unqualified vessels, we said a few weeks ago, to do his work. We talked about that last week and the idea of a message that we carry in the effort to bring about reconciliation. God chooses weak, broken, unqualified vessels to do his work, because then we can't compete for the glory. Because God is always the hero of the story. And so Paul sums the whole thing up with this. He says, therefore, I will boast all the more gladly about my weaknesses, so that in Christ's power, or so that Christ's power may rest on me. That is why, for Christ's sake, I delight in weaknesses and insults and hardships and persecutions and difficulties. For when I am weak, then I am strong. Is there anything within you that would be open to celebrating your weaknesses? Is there anything in you that thinks you could do that? Could you actually turn a corner today in your mind? Could you reverse your perspective and begin to see that your weaknesses are opportunities for God to show strength? What would that look like? Maybe your weaknesses are something physical. There's a woman named Rachel Barkey who, back in 2007, was diagnosed with metastatic breast cancer at the age of 37. Doctors gave her months to live. She would eventually die in May of 2009. Just 2 months before her passing, in March of 2009, she had the opportunity to give a 55-minute talk that she titled, Death is Not Dying. And at that point, her cancer had spread. There were tumors that were pressing in on her brain. She was barely able to walk. And yet, in the midst of her pain, in the midst of the situation, she stood up. She walked out onto a stage. She stood there for 55 minutes, and she spoke to a group of around 600 women in Vancouver. And in her speech, she smiled and she laughed and she quoted scripture. One of my favorite quotes from her message is this. It says, I'm dying, but I'm not dying. I have cancer, but cancer doesn't have me. My hope is not in a cure. My hope is in a person. It's a powerful message. It's incredible to be able to speak that message in such a moment of weakness. It's powerful. Talk was recorded, and after her death, her husband decided to post it online. And that video has now been viewed or downloaded over 2 million times. Her family continues to receive messages well into the thousands from people of all kinds of backgrounds who have said that Rachel's trusting of Jesus, even in death, led them to giving their life to Christ. Therefore, I will boast all the more gladly about my weaknesses, so that Christ's power may rest on me. That is why, for Christ's sake, I delight in weaknesses and insults and hardships and persecutions and difficulties. For when I am weak, then I am strong. Your weaknesses can become something extraordinary through God's strength. Maybe your weakness isn't something physical like Rachel. Maybe it's something more mental like depression or anxiety. This guy is Carlos Whitaker. He's a Jesus follower, worship leader. For years, he battled severe anxiety that had, in his words, left him paralyzed. He struggled with simple tasks like getting out of bed. And in 2007, while on staff at a church, he began writing about his struggles. One of his pastors didn't appreciate his raw honesty about his burdens and struggles. The pastor had feared that it was going to undermine Carlos's witness, but he persisted instead. He shared how prayer and Bible study weren't enough for him to be healthy. He defended the use of Christian therapy and medicine as useful resources to work with him alongside his faith. And he was one of many voices that helped spark a movement. And his story became a catalyst for churches to begin integrating mental health resources. In fact, I bet that if you've been in church for a long time, that you probably never heard anything about mental health before 2007, and now that conversation has become much more common. Since then, Carlos has become a popular podcaster and author who's reached millions. He's received hundreds of messages from readers, including skeptics and longtime believers. One message that I found particularly significant said, your honesty showed me Jesus cares about the mess, not just the mountaintops. He said, I gave my life to him today. Hundreds of people have found faith through Carlos's vulnerability. Therefore, I will boast all the more gladly about my weaknesses, so that Christ's power may rest on me. That is why, for Christ's sake, I delight in weaknesses and in insults and in hardships and in persecutions and in difficulties. For when I am weak, then I am strong. Your weakness can become something extraordinary through God's strength. Maybe your weakness isn't something physical. Maybe it's not mental. Maybe it was something spiritual. Maybe you have an issue of doubt or issues of questioning, and you've struggled in that space for a long time. Many of you may know the name C.S. Lewis, but you may not know his story. Lewis became an atheist in his early teens after his mother's death. He began to believe that the universe was cruel and unjust. Over the course of his young years, he had some friends and other people, some influences, who helped him with some deep searching. And in 1929, Lewis admitted that God was God, and he began to pray. And he describes himself in that time, much later, he looked back and described himself in his writings as being the most dejected and reluctant convert in all of England. His conversion was not instantaneous. It was something that was gradual, and it was a thoughtful process. And Lewis became a voice of deep thoughtfulness about God and the truths of Scripture. His writings continue to carry incredible weight for the doubters and the skeptics even today, nearly a century later. There's a similar story of a guy named Lee Strobel. His story starts with his wife and her conversion. He was an avowed atheist. He struggled that she had put her belief in Jesus. In fact, he wanted to win a debate with his wife so badly that he started studying Jesus. That part of the story makes complete sense to me. I get that one, right? Strobel was an investigative journalist for the Chicago Tribune, and so he began using his skills to try to debunk his wife's new beliefs. He launched into a 2-year investigation to find the historical facts about Jesus. He was driven by his desire to find truth. Many people are converted by what they call a rush of emotion, but Strobel said he was experienced instead a rush of reason, which led him to his conversion to Christianity in 1981. He would take his findings from his studies and write a book called The Case for Christ, which continues to be a foundational study for a reasoned defense for the truth of Jesus and the Scriptures. Doubters and skeptics continue to find hope in his writings today. Therefore, I will boast all the more gladly about my weaknesses so that Christ's power may rest on me. That is why, for Christ's sake, I delight in weaknesses and in insults and hardships and persecutions and in difficulties. For when I am weak, then I am strong. Your weakness can become something extraordinary through God's strength. Maybe your weakness isn't found in your physical body. Maybe it's not something mental. Maybe it's not even something spiritual. Maybe you just have a past. Maybe you have a story. I know people who've experienced the lowest point in their life in the midst of a divorce. And then I've seen those same people become the ones who come alongside other hurting marriages and speak Jesus into very dark places. Weakness becomes Christ's power. If you've been around here for a while, you know the name Brian Pelletier. He's one of our elders. He's a leader of our program called Celebrate Recovery. Maybe you know his story of his addiction, his weakness, and how it has become the way that Jesus has used him to spread the gospel message. But he's not the only one. We've got this other guy here, a guy named Ryan Kurtzinger, who has his own story with substance addictions that have led him to some very difficult spots. He found his way back to Jesus in hope in a recovery home. And now he works for that recovery home passionately. Because through his weakness, the gospel advances. Weakness becomes Christ's power. And I've seen the same thing happen again and again through people whose weakness was anger or bitterness or hatred or racism. I've seen stories of deep pain and deep loss be rewritten through the power of Christ, because the weakness of your past can become the deep encouragement that so many others have needed. This verse is what Paul says of his story, but it's not just his story. This could be your story. You could say, therefore, I will boast all the more gladly about my weaknesses so that Christ's power may rest on me. That is why, for Christ's sake, I delight in weaknesses and in insults and hardships and persecutions and difficulties, because when I am weak, then I am strong. Your weaknesses can become something extraordinary through God's strength. Such a big reverse. It can totally alter everything we think we know. Mighty warriors never set out to be heroes. They only set out to do what God asked them to do. And that, then God just kind of puts them in a spot where they're in over their head and their sufficiency comes from Him. You may think that you're exempt to that. You may think that you could never even be a mighty warrior. Gideon wasn't until he was. Moses wasn't until he was. David wasn't until he was. Same with Peter and John and Paul. And for every one story that we know, there are hundreds of mighty warriors who have silently and without fanfare obeyed their God, and the gospel message has continued to advance. What is a mighty warrior? They aren't mighty because of their own strength or their own power. In fact, it's actually the opposite. God calls unqualified and broken and weak people. Your weaknesses are opportunities for God to show strength. Your weakness becomes Christ's power. And I want to invite you to that. I want to invite you to live like that. It may take on different forms and fashions. Maybe that looks like you just starting a relationship with Jesus today. I'd love to have that conversation with you. I'll be sitting right up front. Come. We can keep going, all right. If you want to have a conversation about Jesus, we can do so in the middle of the service. If you want to meet afterwards, that's acceptable as well, all right? We can make those things happen. We've got an elder in a prayer room in the back. I know that today's conversation about weaknesses, maybe you just need some prayer and some encouragement. We've got an elder back there who'd love to pray with you. I'm up here as well. Don't miss this opportunity and don't miss this big reverse. This could change your life. To begin to see the things that you've struggled with could actually become the ways in which God uses you in powerful ways. Why don't you stand and let's worship.